will get started. So we're entering into the treatment section. Exactly what are we treating? How are we treating? And I'll move through these quickly to make sure we've got time for a Q&A at the end. So current treatment philosophy, there's a lot of blame on families, blame on society, blaming the individual. Society, families, individual definitely plays a part, but it is not the root cause. There is no one root cause, okay? How we really want to look at an eating disorder in terms of philosophy, conceptualization, approach, is what I call the perfect storm, okay? So there's temperament in no specific order, okay? There is temperament, okay? Your personality, if you will, how you are wired, okay? You've got genes, your genetics, and then environment. It's called the perfect storm. Cynthia Bullock out of UNC Chapel Hill, she coined the phrase, genetics loads the gun. Sorry, wait, I just messed it up. Yeah, I just flipped it. Okay, so environment, there we go, sorry. Environment loads the gun, genetics pulls the trigger. Okay, I botched the quote, but that was my that was my one-liner. Genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. Okay, genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. All to say, it's not just one thing. That someone can be genetically predisposed, and maybe their environment doesn't necessarily pull the trigger. Someone could be not necessarily genetically predisposed, but environment really pulls the trigger. The two of them combined, absolutely. Okay? Genetics loads the gun, environment pulls the trigger. And then the additional, that there is always some sort of internal, external experience of feeling out of control, loss of control. I think that's kind of the more commonly talked about, acknowledged, like, oh, it's a control thing. Eating disorders are a control thing. Yes, and. Okay? Yes, and. There is some sort of loss of control, and there's the genetics, temperament, environment piece. Specific to ED care, but also within my own practice and conceptualization, I look at all these aspects to treatment and approach it from all of these standpoints, okay? The biological, the individual, the family, nutritional, medical, group, in terms of treatment, all of it together makes up really effective treatment. Any one piece is not as effective. For the same reason that slide way back at the beginning, eating disorders are complex, this speaks to it in terms of approach to treatment. Specific risk factors for development, these might be the genetic, the environmental, or a specific experience, a specific event, an outlying event. So family history of eating disorders or obesity. I think I had a slide on that. Affective illness or alcoholism in first degree relatives. Some sort of sport or activity that focuses on body size, shape, performance. Okay. At ED Care, we have an entire elite athlete track for patients who are either sponsored or professional athletes, because the degree of intensity around performance is often channeled into an eating disorder. And those that are at high levels of performance specific to these events, cycling, horseback riding, equestrians, jockeying, I don't know if that's a word, swimming, biking, cycling, many, many different sports evolve around maintaining a certain weight and performance. So high performance sports, beware of. Personality traits, this is the temperament, okay? Perfectionism, impulsivity. We'll talk a little bit more about certain temperament characteristics that align with, or that the eating disorder uses in a maladaptive way. How parents eat. It's a factor. It's not a cause, but it can be a factor. How do parents model or not model good eating behavior and good relationship with food? About 65% of our patients have some sort of trauma history. And many times that is physical or sexual abuse. So trauma is an extremely high risk factor variable, if you will, associated with eating disorders. Extremely high. Okay. This speaks to the genetic piece. Individuals with a mother or sister who suffer from anorexia nervosa are 12 times more likely. It's a very, very high genetic relationship. 4 times more likely to develop bulimia. However, even if an individual is at genetic high risk, she may or may not, she may never develop an eating disorder because of the societal, there's no environmental temperament additional variable, okay? There's no perfect storm. It's just part of the storm. It just rained a bit, okay? Speaks to the environment media piece. I have a whole separate presentation on the role of media, not as a cause of eating disorders, but as a proponent of. And this is just a small clip of it. But the 12 to 25 age range is absolutely inundated by media. I am super excited about the afternoon talk. Because I'm sure there's a lot of overlap. So I'm very excited about that. But the access to media, the constant comparison, I will never forget Dr. Richardson saying, what does our fallen mind do the second we meet someone? We instantly size them down. Instantly. There's an instant comparison of how do I measure up to the person next to me? Imagine that in a brain that is trying to form their own identity, their own values, their own sense of self-worth, and it's inundated with comparison. Their life is better than mine. My life is better than theirs. Is it better? I don't know. Is it too much? Is it too little? So the role of social media in painting a perfect image is just part of the perfect storm. Okay? Constant scrutiny, constant self-evaluation. There's this idea of battle of the genders. There was a commercial it was a long time ago, and I actually think that they took it off air because it was really bad. But basically, it was for a brand, Ford or all the other truck brands. I'm blanking on all the other truck brands. But they said you're either soft male or masculine male based on what truck you choose. This aired on television, in public. Soft male, they use the word soft, and I cringed. Thankfully they took it off air. But again, just how do you measure up? Are you true male or not? Are you true female or not? Whole nother topic, but it's our at risk. Individuals are definitely exposed to this. It's just as hard to be Ken as it is to be Barbie. Okay. So what are we treating? This idea of, I call it, there's a disorder of connection. Get to my clip here. This idea of poor temperament, when I say poor, I mean kind of like inadequate temperament, missing something in temperament. But the eating disorder often presents kind of as a disorder of connection, in the sense of there's a longing for connection, there's connection that is missing. okay? And many times that temperament shows up as some of these categories. High harm avoidance, so really, really high amount of avoiding harm. Go to a lot of efforts to avoid harm. These individuals that maintain an eating disorder, they will avoid any sort of conflict or potential harm. They become hermits, they retract. Kind of on the opposite ends is that you have high novelty seekers, okay? So someone who might present with bulimia nervosa, the nature of the illness is more of a novelty seeking. They're impulsive. They ride the crazy roller coaster rides. They get the tattoos. I am still seeing, 2 years ago, when I was here last, I was seeing this patient I'm about to describe, and I'm still seeing her. We're in a long-term, very long-term therapeutic relationship. And if you saw the two of us sitting in the same room together, you would kind of laugh that we might relate. She has very, very blue hair, a lot of tattoos, a snake that's like all the way up her leg, and then you have me, okay? She is a high novelty seeker. She loves to talk about her pet snake. I literally cringe and tell her, I'm sorry, that's one thing you cannot talk about in my therapy, my client, in my room. I just can't handle it. I can't handle it. She's a high novelty seeker, okay? Interestingly, she's also a high harm avoider relationally. Those are the most difficult to treat. She really, really avoids conflict and difficult conversations and will back down from that at the risk of even losing the relationship. And she's also high novelty seeking. Those are tough. Those are pretty tough patients. Low reward dependence, meaning someone low in reward dependence doesn't really respond or feel motivated by an A or feel motivated by a paycheck. They're not dependent on any sort of intermittent or constant frequent reward. They just kind of flop their way through, okay? That's hard to treat. That's hard to sustain a place of recovery if they don't really feed off of any sort of reward dependence. Low persistence, it is what it is. High self-forgetfulness, these are the extreme caretakers, okay? Focus on others, take care of others. I'm not worth being taken care of. You can imagine if there's an eating disorder at play and I easily forget about myself, I'm not gonna address my eating disorder. I'm not gonna address my own internal needs. I'm not gonna address my own spiritual needs because it's gonna be about everyone else and I'm gonna really forget about myself. Low cooperativeness, it is what it is. Very treatment resistant individuals. And then low self-directedness. In terms of this disorder of connection, I want to read a quote. It says, this is from a book called Wasted, a memoir of anorexia and bulimia. You never come back, not all the way. Always there's an odd distance between you and the people you love and the people you meet. A barrier thin as the glass of a mirror. You never come all the way out of the mirror. You stand for the rest of your life with one foot in this world and one foot in another, where everything is upside down and backwards and sad. That's the reality of disconnection from self and others. One foot in some world, one foot in another world. Everything's upside down and sad and backwards, because there's such disconnection. Okay. Specific temperament qualities, characteristics unique to anorexia, high harm avoidance, a neurotic presentation in terms of detail, scrupulosity, focus on the most minute and significant aspects, but oh, it's significant to them. Obsessionality, very, very anxious individuals, extremely reward dependent, okay? Almost to the point of just becoming unnatural, if you will. Perfectionistic, very, very low novelty seeking, low self-esteem. These individuals do not like change. Okay? Change is considered novelty seeking. So these individuals do not like change. And on the opposite end of the spectrum is temperament and bulimia nervosa and binge eating disorder. There's a lot of overlap because of the nature of the binge. Okay, so that's a common denominator between the two. And there's a nature, if you will, there's something that's displayed and acted out in the binge behavior. And many times that could be harm avoidant in nature. Oh, wait, yeah. Neurotic, obsessional, perfectionistic. I think the bottom four are the most important. Low self-esteem. So acting out, overcompensating, if you will, for a deficiency in terms of ego strength, identity. High novelty seeking. The blue-haired client I was telling you about, she has many binge characteristic symptoms. History of, very much in recovery now, but at the time had many binge bulimic tendencies. Very, very impulsive, okay? And then a lot of dysregulation in terms of affect. So they're kind of all over the board. If you, again, a bit graphic, but if you think about the behavior of purging, it's very uncontained. It is very dysregulated in nature. It's very provocative. It is very impulsive at times, okay? So it's an urge that is hard to contain. So if you think about the actual behavior, it often fits with the temperament, just kind of a diagnostic observational tool. This is more or less of the same, but I do want to speak to it. Specifically the fear of being a burden on others, the discomfort with taking up space. Had a 62-year-old patient who really struggled to be basically the center of attention in the room. This was 4 years ago. She was in treatment with us for 6 months plus, and I still keep up with her to this day, and she really struggles to take up the whole time on the phone, or at the time struggled to take up the whole room within our sessions, and was very keen on it being fair. You have your time, Dr. Newman, and then I'll take up some time. And she wasn't comfortable taking up that space. Not coincidentally, she was very, very thin. Extremely underweight. So as she began to restore, we worked on what is it like in your body to literally start taking up space, okay? What is it like emotionally to start taking up space for yourself, for others, with others? What is it like when I put the ball back in your court and I'm not going to take up space, this time is about you? I mean, it was just that in the moment exchange of how does this feel physically, how does this feel emotionally, how does this feel psychologically, to take up that space and to be a significant part of that attachment that we created. Did I put on here? I'm not sure if it's on here. I'm looking quickly. So another common interpersonal trait of eating disorders is, I already mentioned it, that they do not transition well, okay? For many different reasons, mainly temperamentally. But these patients do not transition well. If you are treating patients at a higher level of care, definitely expect this. If you're treating those with eating disorders at an outpatient level, I would expect this to some degree. If you go out of town, it doesn't matter if it's for 24 hours or a week, expect some sort of struggle, some sort of change, some sort of slip. Not relapse, but just some sort of difficulty. Because for the same reason that they struggle to connect, they're going to struggle when you, the significant figure, leave. Okay? Without any exception, every time I leave, I either have a patient completely regress, need to go to a higher level of care, overdose, lose 5 pounds that took 3 weeks to gain. It just happens, okay? Got word Tuesday that my long-term outpatient client, who is currently in our PHP, she was planning to step down while I was gone, which I know, probably not the best timing on my part. It is what it is. Completely overdosed on Benadryl while I was gone. So she's in the hospital right now because it's not all about me, but it's about the therapeutic relationship, okay? Unfortunately, she has not been able to internalize that therapeutic relationship to hold and sustain her. And so I'm holding too much meaning. And she knows that that transition is coming, and she wants to undo the transition that's coming because she doubts and fears and judges and criticizes herself, okay? They don't transition well. They don't. So a lot of our work is preparing for transition, defining transition, redefining transition, working within the transition, all of that. It's a lot of our work. And that transition does not just have to be in terms of level of care. It could be anything. It could be any sort of change in someone's personal, interpersonal, psychological, emotional world. Identifying the function of the eating disorder. This is a key thing. Key piece. I'll read this quote. Guido Frank, who very prominent figure in the eating disorder world, is now out at USC in California. He was on our research team in Denver and recently left us, but he quoted this. He wrote it in his book, but it's a quote from a magazine editor, Kate Taylor. The disease often makes them feel special and unique. Until we discard the victim model and admit that anorexia, though destructive, often fulfills a deep personal need, we can't begin to investigate what makes a person vulnerable to it. So for the rest of this time, you will hear me saying things like, it's not about the food. It's fulfilling a deeper need. It's not about what's on the plate. It's about maybe what's not on the plate, metaphorically. Okay? There is a deeper emotional need. And until that is identified, acknowledged, then it's really hard to, I'll use the word, fix the eating disorder or live in spite of the eating disorder, okay? So the adaptive function, what's the underlying reason for engaging the behavior? What question does it answer? What problem does it solve? How does the eating disorder serve you? I think this might be a question that's often a bit scary to ask because you never want to encourage the eating disorder. It's there for a reason. They resourced the eating disorder for a reason because they didn't have an answer for something else. So it's okay to say, how has it served you? Yes, you will get to how has it not served you. That's obvious by the medical complications and the broken relationships and the inability to sustain work. That's obvious. But what may not be obvious is how it served them. Go for that. Go for that. Because you just want to find that in something else that's not so destructive. Okay? How does it alter the environment in a positive way? Okay? Maybe it brings in attention, needed attention. Maybe it fulfills a need that has been avoided and neglected for a very long time. So how has the environment changed when you restrict? How has the environment changed when you purge? How do you change when you binge? All wonderful questions to ask. Okay? What is or is not present with or without the eating disorder? What mood state does it change, manage? when you act on these behaviors, okay? Down to what's different when you wear an oversized sweatshirt to what's different when you only buy certain foods. You know, it can be any sort of those warning signs or behaviors that we talked about earlier on. Another list, that every behavior is purposeful. That is a Bill Richardson quote from 2000 and, well, probably way before me, but that's his quote. That's when I learned it was 2006. There is a reason that those behaviors are there. Go for that, okay? Go for that. It controls trauma. It numbs. It sedates. It comforts. It soothes. It fixes family dynamics. It brings mom and dad together. If I keep my eating disorder, mom and dad will show up together for the first time, only if I'm sick. Man, that's a risky thing to get rid of if mom and dad only come together over your illness, over your patient's illness. That is a very risky thing. So do I get better and risk losing them, or do I stay sick and keep them? That's a tough moment, okay? Reversal of puberty, desire to remain a child, grieving the loss of childhood. Current patient right now, she just went into this dialogue of, when I am really, really small, I get to be 10 years old, and I somehow imagine that my needs as a 10-year-old will be met, because they certainly weren't when I was 10. It hasn't worked for her, but it's something that she's just realizing of, literally, I regress physically so that I can try to heal that 10-year-old self. So we've been working on how to heal that 10-year-old self in an adult body, okay? Meeting those unmet needs. Maturity fears, absolutely. Avoid, avoid, avoid. The eating disorder prevents them from going to college. It prevents them from getting a real job. It prevents them from maybe failing. It prevents them from maybe succeeding. Because if they stay sick, they never have the chance to fail. They never have the chance to succeed. Maturity fear. I'm going to read a quote speaking to the double bind. But it was by far more important that I get rid of dinner. Of course, by then, throwing up was the only way I knew how to deal with fear. That was the function. That paradox would begin to run my life. To know that what you're doing is hurting you, maybe even killing you, and to be afraid of that, however, but to cling to the idea that maybe this will also save you, me, the author. And that, in the end, will make things okay. What a bind. Knowing on the one hand, this is likely killing me, taking my body, you know, destroying my body, but at the same time, at least for a moment, things feel okay. That's a double bind. Okay? Just a reminder. A few keys to recovery: early recognition, timely intervention, evidence-based approach, and a multidisciplinary team. Goals of treatment. I won't linger on these, but just wanted you to have them. Medical stabilization, nutritional rehab. Patients don't like the word restore because they know it means weight, it means numbers, it means calories. So I use nutritional rehabilitation, okay? Somehow they can accept that a little bit more. It's all the same thing, but for some reason it just clicks in their mind a little bit more. Psychiatric stabilization, emotion regulation, just normalizing eating behaviors, normalizing food. A few empirically supported treatments that have been proven time and time and time again to work with eating disorders. For those of you in school, for those of you possibly starting school, if you're interested in this field, pay attention to these theories as you learn them. Very, very effective. Other therapeutic interventions, art therapy, movement, and psychodrama. These three are very specific because many times patients, they don't know how to verbalize the subconscious. So in art therapy, it's another form, another part of the brain, if you will, that verbalize the emotions, that verbalize the subconscious. That talk therapy doesn't work. I have a patient that it just doesn't work as well for her to do talk therapy. So I have specifically, individually set up art therapy sessions weekly for her. She tells a ton on paper, down to what medium she uses, whether it's a heavy-leaded pencil or a thin-leaded pencil, to the colors that she uses, to the thickness of the paper. She says it all. So it's a lovely collaboration with the art therapist because I'm like, what does this mean? You know, and I'm just, it's super cool. So art therapy is really, really helpful for some of these patients that can't live, that do not possess the ability yet or ever to completely verbalize it. Movement therapy, straight up connection to your physical body. Okay, very, very difficult for our patients. They avoid this group at all costs because they don't know how to be connected to their body in a non-judgmental way. And so we are literally doing exposure therapy and sending them to movement. Anything from like free dance to doing some sort of skit. I'm not a movement therapist, so I could be completely botching this specific field. but any form of movement to engage with their body is really hard. And this is really kind of mean, but I know that there's a reason. We have this group right after the challenge meal where they go out to eat, okay? And then they come back and all they want to do is hide under blankets and sit in the little lounge area. We're going to movement group and you're going to get connection with your body. And they hate us. And that's good. Okay? That's good. Psychodrama. The power of reenactment, corrective emotional experiences, time and time again. Playing out those scenes from childhood, expressing the unmet needs, and seeing a corrective emotional experience of having an attentive father, an attentive mother, an attentive boss through psychodrama is incredibly powerful. Treatment trajectory is progress over perfection. Treatment is not linear. I always show my patients that treatment looks like this. Okay? Treatment is never, recovery is never like this, ever. You make a little bit of progress, but then there's a loop back because something happens. Maybe they're struggling with transition or they get a difficult phone call. There's a little loop here. But you know what? It's not back here. So even though there's a loop, it's still up ahead. So this, I often say this is normal for there to be loops. It's even normal for it to kind of be, you know, a little less incline. But treatment's not linear. Life isn't linear, okay? Recovery requires a village. This is who is on a treatment team at any given point, okay? A multidisciplinary approach, psychiatry, individual psychotherapy, dietary, medical, family therapy, group therapy, and milieu therapist. Milieu therapists are in the trenches, okay, with the patients in the sense of leading groups, being on the front lines, doing more meal therapy with patients, holding a level of structure and containment to the program, okay? So I give a lot of the credit of effective treatment to the milieu therapist. Group therapy is where the power is in terms of treatment because for the same reason that patients with eating disorders really, really struggle with connection, they need group therapy because they need to be exposed to groups of people in order to experience connection. I can only do so much as an individual in session. It's important. One-on-one is important. But man, there's power in Yalom's process group. Okay? Irvin Yalom, soak it up because that is where the power is. for that interpersonal exchange. How do I connect and attach to others? How do they connect and attach to me? How do they react to me? How do I impact others? How do they impact me? It's a beautiful thing, okay? So if you have patients, clients in outpatient, get them to a group. Get them to a support group. If you're so bold, form a support group. Form a group, okay? Wonderful, wonderful place of healing can happen. Family therapy happens once a week at our in PHP, IOP. Daily medical check-ins if needed. Dietary, there's dietary group. There's dietary check-ins. There's meal therapy. It's constant, a dietary approach at a higher level of care. Individual psychotherapy, dependent on how the level of care. So in PHP, I'll meet with a patient individually twice a week. When they bump down to IOP, it's once a week, plus all the other groups that they go to. But a lot of individual work. And then there's just the regular check-ins are at your door all the time. And then psychiatry is also once a week for med management. So it takes a village, all right? Really, all of this is possible in an outpatient setting. There's just a lot of networking and collaboration that has to happen. But if this population is in your line of vision, is in your ballpark, I don't know what metaphor I'm looking for. What?
Wheelhouse,
thank you. Really look to collaborate with other providers here. So, an important piece, something that I want to really hit on is the role of family. I think there's a common misperception that families cause eating disorders, and I've said it before, they don't cause. They may be part of the problem, some sort of dysfunction within the family may be part of the problem. Just last night, my dad asked me, he said, Caroline, can functional families have someone in their family that struggles with an eating disorder? And I said, well, there's really no such thing as a functional family in a fallen world. There's not. And he it was kind of one of those moments where my dad was like, oh, shoot, my daughter knows something. Because he kind of went, well, that was a good point. And like, you just didn't really know where to go from there. And I was like, sorry. But it was a great dialogue because it was like, well, there's really no such thing. I said, there's degrees of function, some more functional than others. And people have different resources in order to develop different coping skills. So, but there's no such thing as a fully functional family because there's no such thing as a perfect family. I said, Dad, to answer your question, absolutely. Absolutely, because a family is made up of fallen individuals longing for a perfect world. I mean, we're all longing for that. So, families do not cause eating disorders. But they might be a variable in it. When someone in a family develops an eating disorder, it's just a signal to pay attention. Okay, it's an alert. It's a light on. What do we need to look out for? What's not working well? What is working well? I think this could go for the same thing as in a friendship group, okay? Someone is struggling with some form of an eating disorder or some symptom of an eating disorder. What might I need to pay attention to, okay? What might I need to speak into? Family members need to set limits that protect the home life of all the family members. Do not let the sickest member of the family set the household rules. This is more of a professional tip, if you will, okay? I'm a firm believer in that the eating disorder needs to know its limits. It needs to be contained. The eating disorder, I'm personalizing it, but to prove a point. The eating disorder needs to know the consequences associated with its reality, with its presence. Meaning, don't let the eating disorder run rampant, okay? I've had parents take away the car keys. I've had parents withdraw financial support. I've had parents, you name it, they take away the privileges, if you will, in order to prove a point that your eating disorder is going to kill you. It will kill you. It's the second highest mortality rate of any mental health illness. So the eating disorder needs to know its own consequences, the individual as well, because remember, they can't see it. See how it all circulates? See how it all happens? Let go of the idea that you can control the behavior of the eating disordered family member. I know that might sound a bit contradictory to what I just said. It's not that you can do it for them, but it's that you can set parameters. You can control the controllables, okay? But some of it you can't control, which is when you either get professional help or you encourage your family members to you refer to a higher level of care, honestly, until they can see the need for something larger than them to control the eating disorder. Parents must work together. This becomes very difficult when there is separation within the family. This can be back to the individual that maintains the eating disorder in order to get parents together or united. If this is the case, pay attention to how your clients sit in the therapy room. It's telling, okay? So you've, time and time again, in our family therapist room, we've got a couch, intentionally just a couch. The identified patient will sit in the middle of the two separated parents. Okay? Mom, dad, they're separated. They don't talk much. Might even be custody issues going on. There's the identified patient with the eating disorder sitting in the middle. My goodness, what a bridge. It's literally happening in front of them. Mom and dad are talking over me. I'm somehow getting fed in that. But gosh, do I have to stay sick in order for them to stay on the same page? I would rather them not fight and me be sick than have them fight and me be recovered. The double bind. Okay? We've discussed a bit about this just in terms of connection, but the importance of reconnection within recovery, it's absolutely necessary. Reconnection to self, others, physical self, mental self, social self, psychological self. And we are time and time again creating a corrective emotional experience for our patients. Literally created a corrective emotional experience for one of my patients. I really love to go to a swing set and swing. Yes, I'm a 36-year-old who likes to swing. It's not regressed, it's just how I like to, I don't know, get in touch with my inner child. But this was with my 62-year-old patient. Okay, somehow we found out that we both love swing sets. Okay, so many of our sessions took place on a swing set, because she had such difficulty connecting to her inner child, who was neglected, who was starved relationally. She struggled with anorexia nervosa. She was starved relationally. And so time and time again, I looked, how can we create a corrective emotional experience for her? And many times that was literally on the swing set, okay? I took a picture of her, because she wanted it, because she wanted to remember the feeling that she had just being on a swing set and being youthful and being attended to. And she was 62, and it was just a beautiful picture, but she had both hands like this, and she had her eyes closed because the sun was beaming down on her, and she just, the smile, she looked like a 10-year-old, and it was just wonderful because she needed some sort of corrective emotional experience that went back so deep to childhood, okay? She needed that reconnection because she couldn't get there on her own. And the eating disorder prevented her from getting there on her own. She was truly happy without her eating disorder in that moment. That moment had nothing to do about her eating disorder, okay? They need that time and time and over again. Connection is a leverage for recovery. Patients want to be connected. They want to be good partners, parents, children, friends, but they're anxious, fearful, and avoidant. We were made to connect. It's a big, big piece. I learned that at RTS. We were truly, truly made to connect, wired and all. And it gets truncated, it gets usurped by things like anxiety and depression and eating disorders. Working through fears of abandonment, conflict. It is possible to move through conflict without ending a relationship. These are for the high harm avoidant individuals. I often tell my patients, I'm gonna fail you, okay? You're gonna be mad at me. I'm gonna fail you. You're gonna wish I'd said something different. Let's just get that out, that I am really imperfect. And you know what? At the end of the day, we can schedule our next session. Or maybe the end of the week. Maybe it takes a month. I don't know. But we can keep scheduling the next sessions, because you can stay in relationship without your eating disorder, just regardless of how fearful you are. Okay? You do possess that ability. That is how you were made. That's how you were created. For that connection.